Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ricky at a certain point realized that we're gonna have to roll it back a little bit, because the scene as is, I don't think Netflix would have gone for it. I really don't.
Lost for words. It's just, how long did it take you to master the double nostril recorder?
A few hours a day for a few weeks, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Blimey, did me, head in.
All worth it now, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
So I haven't got a job.
No?
No, because I've got lots of time.
Use it wisely. Funny, because it was only this morning I was thinking my life was worthless, and then makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah. Get a picture.
Recorder's in. Stick them up there. There you go. Fuck me.
From Afterlife, it's Ethan Lawrence. Ethan, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Tom. How are you?
I am all the better. Well, I did say this, all the better for speaking to you, which I am. And don't get me wrong, but before we sat down today, I thought...
It sounds less sincere the second time.
It's only because before we sat down today, I thought I need to finish watching season 3. So I know what we're talking about. And, it got me a bit there, which is weird in the office. Like, it's a bit of a heartbreaker at the end, isn't it?
Oh, you did it at work as well.
Yeah. It's a rough one, but it's a beautiful series. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's a labor of love, and I think I'm just really, really thrilled with it.
How did you find the reaction to the third series?
I mean, it's almost been overwhelming. Like, the amount of people who have got in contact with me to like talk about not only like the funny parts, but also like to share their own stories of grief and like, you know, talk about it and open it up. It's opened up my world to lots of conversations about grief and about loss. And like, I'm so honored that people want to share that with me. And, you know, this whole experience has been mind blowing, and I could not be happier with how it all turned out in the end.
World is moves in mysterious ways, and it came to light that you're also a massive wrestling fan.
Yes. We were sort of semi introduced by way of Twitter.
Yeah.
Cause I was tweeting about how I was in a bad mood, so I was just going to lie down and watch wrestling until I passed out. And somehow you were then brought into my orbit, and we connected through that way. And I did watch wrestling until I passed out that night, so it was all good.
Out of interest, what wrestling were you watching?
I'm at present, and I don't know if it will change, but I am a huge AEW fan. That's sort of been my bread and butter. It's what brought me back into watching wrestling after a long time in the wilderness. That was it. I mean, that must have been a dynamite that I was watching that night.
It's amazing how so many people who were lapsed fans have been brought back through AEW, because it's certainly got that old school wrestling vibe that I think so many of us are still chasing, hasn't it?
I think that's it. I think the old school vibe is exactly what it is. Like, it's just point A to point B booking. And sometimes that's all you need. Like, you know, a good story well told. And like, you know, I touch in with WWE essentially once a year, and that's the Rumble. And I understand you have feelings about this year's Rumble, so we don't need to go into that.
you've seen the rant that I went on then. That's good to know.
I agreed with every word.
Thank you. Like, it broke my heart to say that it was the worst Rumble I'd ever seen. It genuinely did. I say it with no joy. I know some fans take great joy in dunking on WWE. I get no joy from saying I hated the Rumble. The Rumble's my Christmas as a wrestling fan.
It's the best step. It's the best time of the year.
It's like the Christmas I didn't get Mr. Frosting. That's what we're dealing with. But you know what? We're here to celebrate the wrestling that you love, Ethan. The particular matches, the particular moments that you love. And we're going to send you metaphorically onto a desert island. And whilst you're on that island, you can watch three wrestling matches. You can choose three wrestling matches to burn onto a DVD or a Blu-ray or watch on a laptop next to some of Brian's porn. You choose those three wrestling matches. So what would you like your first match to be, Ethan?
Well, we may as well, since we're on the subject, I it would be remiss of me not to include a Rumble.
Yeah.
Because it is my favorite step. But then that then opens up so many possibilities. Like, do you go for one in the year of my birth, 92, Ric Flair, I'm going for number three all the way through. It's not fair to Flair. Like, wonderful Rumble. Do you go for 2001? That's a great one. That one's so much fun. 08, John Cena's return, and an absolutely stacked Rumble all the way through, because at that point, I think WWE potentially had the best mid-card they ever had. 2010, the Passion of the Michaels. You know, do you go for that? Do you go for 2020? Brock's dominance, and then the Claymore kick heard around the world? But no. I know which one I'm going for. It's 2018. It has to be.
Okay, so why does 2018 get the nod over all of those other ones?
I just feel that it's a Rumble that has absolutely everything. Like, from a great choice for a winner, a great choice for a final six even. But then you go back all the way to the beginning of the Rumble and you have the humiliation of Heath Slater. Genuinely one of the funniest things I think I've ever seen in wrestling. He comes in, I think, at number five, gets immediately flattened by Baron Corbin. And then the next five entrants also flatten him. And then Birthday Sheamus comes out. Big old Birthday Sheamus chucks Heath Slater into the ring and then is immediately eliminated by Heath Slater. Absolutely hilarious. I love it. But I just think in terms of sort of like the build of a Rumble, like every sort of aspect of it, the comedy aspect, like, you know, the stretch in the middle. And I mean, even some of the returns were wonderful. And that final six, it always makes me smile so much when you have the new blood versus the old blood. And Rey Mysterio's there standing in between John Cena and Randy Orton looking like their very, very tiny child. It also, for me, features one of the best calls that Jerry the King Lawler ever made. When John Cena emerges and the boos start immediately just raining down. Like, the good 5 seconds of booze, then John Cena sucks. And then just a little voice, Jerry the King Lawler goes, they love him. Brilliant.
Lawler completely choosing to not read the room on that one and just go, oh, no, they like John Cena. That's absolutely fine.
The selective deafness of the commentary team.
That particular Rumble as well. Really memorable for, as you say, that final sprint towards the end. But it was the Shinsuke Nakamura moment for me that solidified like how much passion there was for like the new blood and the old blood, and how you had, I believe I've got the right Rumble. If I haven't, please correct me. It was Finn Balor, Shinsuke Nakamura, John Cena and Randy Orton. John Cena and Roman Reigns at the very end.
Yeah. That was the final thing. Finn Balor was the Iron Man.
That's it.
So, I mean, he put in an absolutely stellar performance, like, you know, real, real good Iron Man loving. But then, as you say, right at the end, you've got Nakas, you've got Balor, Cena and Reigns. And you look at that, and considering, you know, if you cut back to 2018 and think about where the Rumbles were at that point, we'd had a string of quite disappointing Rumbles. You know, partly through the fault of booking, partly through some people not being who they were supposed to be at the time. Daniel Bryan should have won a Rumble. And so you're looking at that lineup and you're like, well, that this is a dead cert for either Cena making it three or Reigns making it two. It has to be. Like, they're not going to give it to Shinsuke, are they? They're not. And then you can go around in circles for ages about, yeah. And like, you can go around in circles, like, you know, what happened next, you know, the road to WrestleMania, maybe not the best thing. And perhaps Nakamura was mistreated from there out. But that moment where he drops his little hands and does the, come on! And then, out he goes, like, incredible.
Yeah, Shinsuke winning the Rumble felt so good. And it really brought back a lot of faith for me, watching the booking team going like, don't you dare, don't you have Roman eliminate Nakamura. Oh, you didn't. Well, okay. And then, as you say, what goes on from there is an underwhelming match between him and AJ at WrestleMania, which was a real shame.
But I mean, for that moment, I mean, it's everything I think coalesces around the 2015 Rumble. You know, that was the time when Roman wasn't Daniel Bryan, when he really needed to be Daniel Bryan. And God, that image when he wins and like he's bleeding from his mouth and The Rock standing there holding his arm up in triumph and just looks baffled. It's an incredible picture. I look at it every time and I'm like, this is the perfect distillation of someone making the wrong choice.
They don't understand. But now we're at a point with Roman Reigns where like they have leaned in to the fact that nobody likes him. And he has become the best character in the company, hands down.
The best time to have turned Roman Reigns heel would have been 2015. And the second best time was when they did, I think.
Absolutely. When did you become a wrestling fan?
My sort of route into it is quite interesting. I didn't have access to like watching things because I didn't have Sky or anything like that. So it was quite difficult to get hold of at the time. But I loved the games. I remember the first time I played a wrestling game. It was a PlayStation 1. WWF SmackDown, and I loved the look and aesthetic of the thing, and it made me excited about wrestling. Like, you know, even though I wasn't actually seeing what was happening in real life, I could build my own little stories, and that continued all the way through. Like, Here Comes the Pain on PS2, I think probably one of the best games of all time. And I loved the Rumble. Then I'd just play Rumbles over and over and over again just to see what would happen. But my first experience with live wrestling was at Butlins in Skegness.
And this is a big part of wrestling in the UK that I always like to tell American fans about. The Butlins, the holiday camp shows, like the camp shows is what a lot of British wrestlers will use to cut their teeth. So was it a WWE Butlins show or was it like a British wrestling Butlins show?
It was a British wrestling one. I remember that. You'll have to forgive me. My memory is fuzzy. This would have been around 2004, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And my one big memory, and I think, you know where I'm going with this, they had an over-the-top broke battle royale, otherwise known as. And my one distinct memory is that there was a tag match earlier in the night. And there were these two massive sort of like, well, two hosses, but like, you know, in the vein of your giant haystacks or your big daddies. And I remember they wore orange overalls and huge they were, absolutely enormous. And I remember one was called Hull.
I remember I was
hope as in the boat.
I was about to say you might have been thinking of the UK Pitbulls, potentially. That sounds like it could have been the Pitbulls.
Potentially, but maybe they were going under a different name at the time.
Maybe.
Because one was definitely called Hull. I remember it so distinctly.
But that is, as you say, in the vein of like Big Daddy Giant Haystacks, just big lads throwing people around in a rumble. And it was this was British wrestling sort of coming out of a really weird time because we had at this point it was tribute shows. It was UK Undertaker and UK Kane, and the indie scene in the UK was trying to find its feet once more. And I love the fact that that was your first. So did you go into that sort of with any knowledge of wrestling, or was it just a case of there's a show on whilst we are on holiday, we'll take you to see it just to shut you up, and you loved it?
Well, it was so, as I say, my knowledge of wrestling at that point was largely through the games and sort of what I could gather from the early internet. You know, this is pre-YouTube even. So, you know, my knowledge there was limited. This was just the entertainment that evening. You know, it wasn't anything sort of like specific. It wasn't sort of like a special trip. The entertainment that evening was, oh, we're going to put on it. We're going to put on a wrestling show. And like, I wasn't upset by that. But like, we were going to go anyway. So it was a great opportunity. He was definitely called Hull.
I'm going to Google. I'm going to see if I can find anything on Google.
And I remember because when he was eliminated from the Battle Royale, he went over the top rope and landed directly in front of me on his bum. And he was crisscross applesauce, sat there weeping. And it was genuinely one of the greatest moments because he was a heel and I didn't like him.
I've got UK wrestlers from Hull. And it's giving me Nathan Cruz. Well, do you know what? We've put this out into the world. If you are Hull, because I thought you might have been thinking of Bulk, but if you're definitely saying it's Hull, then...
Definitely Hull.
Okay, if you are Hull, reach out.
You landed in front of me during a Battle Royale in Butlins.
And it changed Ethan's life forever. So with yourself though, Ethan, as well, like you discovered the world of acting quite early on, and there was always a passion there. Was there ever any interest in maybe trying the wrestling malarkey yourself?
I still sometimes in the long dark nights of the soul, I do sometimes lie there and think, I'd make a good heel manager though. I would. I never had like the athleticism, I think, to be sort of like a main contender. And I was fine with that. You know, that's okay. But I do have pretensions to being quite a good heel manager. I think I could take a bump or two, like, you know, to pop the crowd. Who knows? I'm manifesting it. I'm putting it out there into the world. We're going to find Hull and I'm going to be a heel manager. I'm going to be Hull's manager. That's how we're going to do this. It all comes full circle.
And the dream is realised. The dream is realised.
The boyhood dream.
What inspired you to get into the world of acting in the first place? What was the inspiration there?
It seemed so trite, but it was literally just being exposed to drama in a curricular space for the first time, which was essentially when I started secondary school, which was also around 2004. So there were a lot of pivotal moments happening in my life at that time. But I discovered drama there and I found sort of two things. One, that I really, really enjoyed it. And two, that I kind of had a knack for it. Comic timing and things like that came to me quite naturally. So I thought, well, let's run this up the flagpole and see how far we go. And then follows amateur musical theatre, then follows taking it to sixth form, A level, and then finally onto university, where I studied drama and creative writing. And then partway into the second term of my first year, I get a call to go and audition for Bad Education. I go in and I get it. And then 2 weeks later, I'm on a professional TV shoot wondering what the hell happened.
Wow. That quickly, it just rolled around.
Yeah. I was 19 years old and I hadn't even finished my degree.
How did that? Like, was it just a case of they were just looking for people and you just threw your hat in the ring for it?
So my understanding was that most of the cast was in place by that point. And they were looking for sort of like a Joe, essentially. And there's some people in the mix, but they decided to open up the audition out. And so I was put forward by my then agent, who was the husband and wife team that ran the amateur musical theatre company that I did all the amateur musical theatre with. So I had a little connection there. In I go. And they were, as I say, not far away from shooting and sort of still floundering around for a Joe. And they decided to take a punt on me. And so it's all their fault, is what I'm saying.
You said in interviews in the past that you owe so much to that gig because it came so quick and everybody was, you know, it seems like there was a lot of love for you amongst everybody there.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think it helps that, like, setting it in a school. I'm so sorry, the recycling vans arrived. You might be able to hear that.
Did you put your bin out?
Yeah, of course I did. Well, glass and plastics. It's not. It's not proper bin day until next week.
Right. Fair enough. Fair.
This is not. This is not the question that you asked.
It's good to know, though. It's good to know that you recycle.
Being set in a school, like, you know, we had a certain level set of archetypes. You know, we had, you know, my role is sort of like the put upon chubby kid. You know, we have the bully. We have the theatre kid. Like, you know, all of those archetypes are recognizable. Like, you know, there's nothing wrong with using archetypes because they're archetypes for a reason. And the reason is that people were able to connect with it in a way that was sort of, you know, I felt kind of a lot of responsibility for it in a way, especially playing sort of like a kid who was being, you know, put upon and in certain aspects bullied. So I recognized the weight of that on my shoulders. And it was a good way to set me up for how I conduct myself with my acting moving forward. Because I always think to myself, right, well, I need to put everything that I've got into this because there are people out there who could end up relying on me for it. And, like, you know, I don't think of it as sort of like a weight on my shoulders or as like some kind of grand destiny or anything like that. But just simply that, you know, people connect to certain characters in a certain way. So you just got to do your best job. And I think that's something that Bad Education taught me, simply by dint of, you know, it being my first exposure to people reacting to my work in real time near enough.
So from there, like, because Bad Education was such a well-received series, and it throws you into the acting world so quickly. Where do you go from there? Because there must be a passion to continue to push up into more and more projects from there.
So initially, we had no idea what was going to happen. Like, you know, we made series one. It was for BBC3, you know, a digital only channel. There's nothing wrong with that. But, like, you know, you think to yourself, what is the legs on this? Like, you know, it was largely untested. And it comes out and it breaks records. And so they're like, right, okay, now we want a series two and a series three and eventually a film. But you got to remember, in between the shooting of it, which was in the February, March of 2012, through to the release, which was more towards the autumn, I'd near enough thought to myself, well, that was fun. You know, what a dalliance that was with acting in a professional setting. I don't need to think about that again because it's never going to happen. And then suddenly it does start happening. And then I'm talking to my now agent. And, like, you know, we're connecting and, like, auditions are starting to come in. And it's like, we're doing this. We're making a go of this. Like, something could happen here. And so essentially, I mean, I've always described it as being 99% luck. But once you've had that lucky break, you just have to hang on and hope that you can maintain. It's all graft from then on in.
So, I mean, we'll touch back into the acting in a second, because, you know, we'll lead you into many other projects like Horrible Histories and, of course, Afterlife that everybody's talking about. But we are here to talk about wrestling. So to get us back onto track just a little bit, what would you like your second match to be for your desert island, Ethan?
I worry. I'm looking at my choices and I feel I may be accused of some recency bias. but, you know, I'm an AEW boy, so I'm moving on to the AEW stuff now. And an oft-overlooked match, I think. I am choosing the triple threat for the AEW World Championship at Double or Nothing, May 30th, 2021. Kenny Omega versus Pac and Orange Cassidy. For me, I think represents one of the things that I love about AEW, which is it's just pure work rate. Like, you know, we can talk about, I mean, a lot of people would maybe pick one of the sort of more high-flying ones. I mean, I did and ah for a long time about whether putting the Bucks versus the Lucha Brothers in a steel cage on there, just for the sheer insanity of it all. But for about 15 to 20 minutes, these three start at 200% and stay there. Like, it is constant. Like, you know, the near falls, the big finishes, it just keeps moving at such a clip. Like, these three are absolutely at the top of their game. And they're still able to maintain the storytelling and the drama. You know, even as it's going on, like, you know, you've got all these spots happening simultaneously, but every single near fall, you're on, your heart's in your mouth. I think the three of them are very, very good at the delayed kick out of two, which always helps. And it's one of those things where you could let yourself believe that Pac could be the AEW World Champion or Cassidy. This could be it for Kenny Omega. And that's the kind of wrestling I love, where you have a situation where it feels impossible for either of, well, if it's a one-on-one, it feels impossible for any of those men to lose.
That's the joy of a match like that, where you literally are guessing all the way through who's actually going to win the thing. And that's where there's a joy. When I don't know how much you get to show or talk about wrestling with non-wrestling fans, but I'm always intrigued as to how people you know around you react to wrestling as a whole, but maybe Orange Cassidy.
I'm the biggest wrestling fan I know, which means that I'm not and I mean that in the sense that my particular circle, there aren't many wrestling fans in there. But I do occasionally try to push interesting little videos or, like, you know, show them something. And funny enough, you bring up Orange Cassidy, and that's one of the ones that I always like to do, because it's just a funny gimmick. It's just funny to watch. It's pure clowning. The bit that the one that always is the one I tend to turn to most is, funnily enough, Orange Cassidy versus Pac. That initial one quite early in AEW's lifespan, where we first got the light super kicks of death and the hands in pockets, incredible athleticism with the vaults and the flips and the kip ups and everything like that. Because you look at that and you go, yeah, it's silly, but he's really good though, that Orange Cassidy. He is.
He's very, very. And I love in that match, in particular, the one you mentioned there with Pac, there is a beautiful moment. And Pac is so serious. He's a serious Geordie. And there's a moment in that, a glorious moment, where Pac corpses when he sees Orange Cassidy rolling towards him. And you'd never catch Pac out very, you don't catch Pac out at all, if very often. But in that glorious moment, you see Pac sort of cracking a little, trying, like, moving away, like trying to hide the fact that he's smiling away. And I love it. It's so good. It's so good. Anybody on the set of Afterlife wrestling fans?
Not so far as I'm aware. They didn't make themselves known. Yeah, maybe there's some stealth ones around.
I feel like Gervais might be an Impact fan. I don't know why.
He gives off that kind of vibe, doesn't he?
Gives off a fan that he likes Impact Wrestling. How did you come to get involved with Afterlife?
So really just by the standard way of things, and when it comes to sort of like the acting industry, I just went up for an audition. Mm. Span round, the casting director was a lady called Tracy Gillam, who people who work in my industry have such fondness for, because she's absolutely incredible. A number of you know, huge shows that everyone loves, she has casted them, and she's extremely good, and I owe at the very least 75% of my career to her. So that's good. So I went round. It was very, very simple, because at that time in series one, as the character later expanded, but it was the character was called Recorder Kid back then. And so all I had to do was just a little bit of, you know, physical theater with the recorders, ha 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 ha. Got the part, and it was like, right, well, it's a day, you know, just one day to go in. Well, I could not have been on that set for longer than 2 hours. You know, I got to meet Ricky, I got to meet Tony Way, got to meet Joe Hartley, who I was doing the scene with. And it was like, okay, cool, brilliant. Cheers, everyone. See you later. And off I went. And then my career fell apart. And I went off to do pizza delivery for a while, because the roles, they just weren't coming in, Tom. They just weren't coming in. The idea for the part sort of emerged simultaneously as my own career was in the doldrums. But I mean, you know, it's so interesting, I think, because in series one and series two of Afterlife bookended the lost year in pizza delivery. So it was the last thing I did before I went in, and then it was what pulled me out at the other end. Not only are you coming back, we want you in all six episodes, and your character has a name now, an actual Christian name. And yeah, it was absolutely incredible. And you know, I handed him a notice and everything like that, and I'm off to go make television again, lads, bye. So basically what I'm saying is, you remember I mentioned that thing about it being 99% luck?
Yes.
Yeah, it's 99% luck. Like, it always seems to come about just when I need it. I've been very fortunate in that regard.
Is there something to be said, though? Because I get that people say it's a lot about luck, but surely you put enough into that role that they felt this is a character that can bring us more.
To a degree. I mean, I don't like to toot my own horn, but I like to think I'm all right at acting. But I do think a lot of it comes down to being the right actor in the right room in front of the right people. One of my early roles was in a sitcom that sadly only went for one series called Trying Again on Sky Living, which was a co-production between Simon Blackwell and Chris Addison. And in my audition, I just did a bit of business. Like so the character, he's nervous for a driving test. And so to hide his pit stains, he attaches sanitary towels to his armpits. And in the audition, I just sort of did this little gesture where I sort of lifted it up and looked profoundly upset with myself. And it was that bit of business that caught Simon Blackwell's eye and then got me on that show. And so I wonder sometimes, like, yeah, acting skill is necessary to be able to do what you do. But like, I was able to do that in front of like that scene, that recorded scene in front of Ricky on that day, potentially when he was in a good mood. And, you know, he saw something there. So yeah, sure. Skill's a big part of it, but it really is so much down to where you are and what you're doing while you're there and who else is there.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I want to just quickly touch back on how, you know, between series one and series two of Afterlife, you've gone back into Peter's delivery. And I think a lot of people miss this sometimes. I guess they just assume once you've done a hit show like that, then you're made and you're off and you're away. And it's really not the case. So the fact that, you know, you did that show, you did the episode of it, and then, you know, you, normal life comes back. But what goes through your head during that year where you are a part of something that is so successful, but you can't quite climb back up that ladder? You're metaphorically touching the money in the bank briefcase and you've got fingertips on it, but you can't quite get there. Somebody keeps power bobbing you off the ladder last every chance you get. What goes through your mind as you're working through all that?
I love the way you phrase that question. I really do. I'm romantically in love with it. What goes through my head? I mean, it was supposed to be a stopgap, like, you know, because the reason why I chose pizza delivery specifically is because I thought to myself, well, I can work evenings and I'll still have the day free to go out and audition. So really, it was just supposed to be a stopgap. It's like, this won't be long. This is temporary. You know, I'll be here for what, 6 to 10 weeks. And then that turns into 3 months, turns into 6 months, turns into a year. And the whole time I'm thinking to myself, you know, I should stress, I'm not, because it's difficult when you talk about this, because like there's a tendency to maybe word it in a bad way, which makes it sound like I'm better than pizza delivery. And I'm absolutely not. That's definitely not the point that I'm making. More so that like, it's not where I wanted to be. Like, you know, I didn't want to become a regional manager. You know, I wanted to be an actor still. And so it's kind of a combination of intense panic and slow burn fear at the same time. Because day to day, you're thinking to yourself, well, where are the auditions? I need them. And then on the other hand, you're thinking to yourself, the longer I'm out of the public consciousness, the less likely I'm going to have to get back in, because momentum is such a hard thing to maintain. I mean, the parallels with like wrestling booking is really quite extraordinary when you think about it. Because once if you're hot, you're the best thing in the world. But if you're cold, no one will touch you. And it can just be one event that stimmies that momentum and stops everything moving forward.
And with all that going on, and you're worried about going cold all the time. And I think it's something that probably a lot of actors like yourself go through. But you go back to season two. But what's the how were people that you worked with in that pizza delivery place with you? Was there weirdness about it? Were they supportive of you? Did they want you to get back out there? What was the vibe with the people you work with?
I was very lucky to have a clutch of really kind managers who were very supportive of me and what I was doing. And like, you know, because eventually when I said like, you know, oh, I'll work nights, it'll be fine. Eventually I was taking every hour God sent to try and do it. But they were very kind with being flexible if I needed to dash off and audition for something. I don't think I honestly could have worked alongside anyone better in terms of sort of like how they could compensate for me, but also their support. And it was genuinely a really nice place to work. Like, you know, again, I'm very cautious to sort of not denigrate the profession. I had a really good time. Like, it was a genuinely nice place to work. But it was sort of like, this is great, but like, this is, at the back of my head, I'm thinking to myself, this needs to be temporary. Because I need to get back. I need to go do some acting, because genuinely it's the only thing I know how to do and I'm good at it. So let's get back to that, shall we?
And you got back to it with Afterlife Series 2 and Season 3, where you have a much beefier role in the show. A lot of the time spent hanging around Brian, played by David Earle. And there is a beautiful chemistry between you two. And I really hope that this transitions away from the camera, I would hope.
For sure. I mean, interestingly enough, if you go back to Season 2 and rewatch it, there is some scenes, but there's not actually that much between James and Brian that we see on camera or in the script. It was one of those things where, because we were spending time in the newsroom and weren't necessarily the key focus of the scene, we'd be in the back of shot, like mucking around, like, you know, doing something funny. And the cake scene being a great example of that. And so this kind of natural chemistry sort of formed between myself and David. And I think, Ricky's got a really good eye. He spotted that and thought to himself, well, that's the money relationship. You know, that's the one that we can carry forward into Series 3. And what a pleasure it was to spend so much time around Brian's mad brain.
I always like to talk about stories from the set. And there's one that caught my eye in another interview you did. I think it was one of the, it might be one that David did. There was the scene with you in the bath that got too much. And it had, because it was very ad-libbed and very free-flowing. Could you tell the story that we're talking about?
For those who haven't seen Afterlife Series 3, minor visual spoiler, this is the second time I'm naked in a bath in this series. And the lines as written sort of gave this... I'm not sure how deep I can go, because I do not want to get your channel demonetized and nuked.
Do you know what? It's fine. It's the podcast feed, so it's fine. We can fucking swear and stuff, so no worries about that.
Okay, so in the script, Brian talks about how normally in this bathroom there'd be a stack of porn and he can shoot ropes like a good one. We get the script as written. It's there. We've got it. It's canned. Now it's time for play. And so the cum shot ends up in different places. Sometimes it ends up just on my face, sometimes in my eye, down my throat was one that ended up in the bloopers. And then to carry on on that theme, he then, I should stress as well, while I'm having this bath, he's sat on the toilet having a poo. And so... Once he's done that dialogue, ending up wherever it is, you know, in my eye, on my elbow, on my knee, or whatever it is, up my bum, he then simulates taking a poo, describing it as like trying to pass a Zeppelin. And I think Ricky at a certain point realized that we're gonna have to roll it back a little bit, because the scene as is, I don't think Netflix would have gone for it. I really don't. It's, you're treading a fine line at all times with Brian Gittins, and I think we may be overstepped the line. But you know, Ricky's got that footage now. He can watch that whenever he wants.
That's one for his own personal collection to keep forever.
And why not? Why not?
How did you get on with Ricky? Because obviously you know, being in the show, pulled in different directions. You, I don't know how much time you got with him, but how did you get on with Ricky when you were with?
Ricky's a great person to work for. Famously, I mean, you send any person who's worked with him onto, you know, a breakfast show or a magazine show, and they'll sit on the sofa and talk about how he wants to always finish early, which is true. You know, the normal shooting days are condensed down by 3 hours, which is amazing because you get an opportunity to rest and relax. And like, if you have a family, go and see them, because normally you can't do that when you're working. He is an incredible director who works with such economy and such speed. But the fact that he also gives us the freedom to play is what makes that set so fun. And the real genuine freedom that you have when you just, like, the camera's on and it's just like, go, see what happens. Ricky's a really nice guy. Like, you know, he treats everyone on the set with respect. He allows his actors to play. And he, you know, these are pyramid structures. So if Ricky's at the top because actor, writer, director, he's at the top. And so, you know, everything else trickles down. And it's a lovely pyramid to be in. A real pleasure to work with.
That's lovely to hear. I mean, I'm going to... Now, if you haven't seen... season 3 of Afterlife, this might be where you want to spin on a little bit, because I do want to ask about the last episode, about those about sort of the way that it all wraps up, and you may not be able to tell me, you might do, it all feels very much the end, like that's the last season of Afterlife we're gonna get.
That's what Ricky has said in interviews, and I believe it is the correct choice. I don't know how much more we could pile on at this point. I think the point has been made, and I think better to go out on a high than sort of drag it out just for the sake of dragging it out.
I think, and the thing is with Ricky Gervais and the work that he does, we talk about Office, talk about talk about Extras, talk about all those seasons he's done, all those shows he's done. They are finite. They don't run, unless they're the American versions, in which case they'll just go on until the end of time. But the UK versions are very finite. And I always like the integrity that comes from that. Like, even though The Office was an absolute smash hit, Ricky Gervais knew it's going to be 2 seasons and a Christmas special, and then that's that. We're gonna tie a bow in it. And with this as well, you know there'll be calls for like a season 4, a season 5. But Ricky's gonna go, no, 3 seasons, and that's it. And the ending itself, I think the ending has been I think there's different interpretations you can make of it, because the ending shows him walking off with the dog, with the wife, and everybody vanishes. Which gives you the impression that in this last episode he dies.
It is an interpretation. I think that final shot for me exists more as a metaphor than as a literal thing,
right?
Because we also have like the visual of the leaves changing. So this is not to say that that interpretation is wrong. It is a metaphor. You can interpret it in as many different ways as you like. Simply from my own personal feelings on it. It represents life going on. You know, we have the transition of time. We have people coming in and out of his life. And so that for me, that's sort of the kind of the thesis statement of the show in a nutshell. Like, you know, we have all this stuff about grief. We have, moments of high comedy and moments of high drama. But at the end of it all, these are people living in a small town and life goes on no matter what. And how you feel about that it's irrelevant in the grand scheme, but totally relevant on a micro level, because, you know, we're all essentially the main characters in our own story.
Right.
And like, you know, Afterlife could have been, you know, you could have shot Afterlife from the perspective of Kath, say, Diane Morgan's character. you'd have a wildly different show, but I do think it would have the same sort of thematic drive, especially if you shot it from Matt's perspective, played by Tom Basden. Like, you know, he, something that in the dialogue touches on in series three, which is when Tony, Ricky's character, apologizes to Matt, simply saying, "I lost my wife, but you lost your sister."
Yeah.
"And you never had, you gave me the space to grieve, but I never did the same back."
Is that final bit at the end, that sort of final segment, those two have segment, like a wrestling word.
segment. This last promo when
Tony,
that they have.
When Tony turns face at the end. but it's that far now. He was a face all the way through. He was like Steve Austin. There was even glass shattering in one episode. But it's that final bit, it's that bit at the end, like you say, where he, and so much of it is, oh, it just, it punches you right in the heart. And it's the bit where he says, like, "I always thought that, you know, not caring was the superpower, when actually it's the opposite. And it's the idea of making people feel good. That's the superpower." And that's, it means so much, because that's something that I, as a person, have always bought into, is that there's so much anger in the world and everybody's so desperate to shout about how tough things are and drag down things they don't like. And we as a people are so reluctant to share the good and make people feel good. And there is no better feeling in the world than making someone feel good. And that is the real message that comes. It's been there the whole time, but it really comes home at the very end, which I think is really, really beautiful. Yeah, I really, and that's that last episode. Again, I watched it before I came to speak to you. And I was just like, "Oh, okay." That's
still reeling. And now we need to talk about wrestling.
Yeah, wrestling. Okay, so your final match, Ethan, for your DVD.
Oh God, well, that was a segue. I didn't realize it was a segue.
Segged like a boss. We went from Royal Rumble 2018, Shinsuke Nakamura's big night. Come on! AEW Revolution Pack versus Cassidy versus Kenny Omega for the AEW title. What would you like your third and final match to be, E?
Right, so you know I said about recency bias. CM Punk versus MJF from the February 2nd episode of Dynamite.
Now that there is a lot of recency bias going on here. I mean, I get it. But what, do you know what? Here's what's nice, Ethan. Here's what's nice is that when we have these shows normally, it's people reflecting on, you know, wrestling of the 80s, the 90s, the early noughties. It's nice to have someone like yourself on who's going, wrestling's still good now. Let's talk about it now. It's true.
It's so good. And like, between those two AEW matches that I've picked one that was all work rate, and in this one I've selected one that was just sublime storytelling. Absolutely sublime. Like, you think to yourself, like, you know, some matches are destined to go long. Like, you know, recently we've had Danielson versus Page, which, you know, those are a couple of really long matches. And I like that they're sort of leaning into that. So MJF Punk goes 40 minutes thereabouts, and we have one major false finish about 15 minutes in. And then the rest of it is just incredible, like, selling of limb work from Punk, the increasingly sort of unraveling mind of MJF. And you have, I think, in those two, is this again, maybe it's because I'm fast approaching the 10-year anniversary of my acting career, but I look at Punk and MJF, and Punk left the industry just before MJF joined it. And now you have this match between the wily old veteran and the young up-and-comer. And they are both so good. Like, they represent both, I mean, for Punk, he represents, like, you know, wrestling's past, but also wrestling's present, and then confronting wrestling's future. I truly believe that we're going to be talking about MJF in the same way that we talk about Triple H, in the same way that we talk about Shawn Michaels, in the same way that we talk about Stone Cold. He has greatness written all over him, and I think it was absolutely, spoiler alert, it was absolutely the right decision to have MJF go over here.
Do you know what? CM Punk is this kind of guy that would 100% get behind something like that. And the story they told in the run-up to it, those battle of words across different episodes of Dynamite, the barbs that were thrown back and forth, MJF saying that, you know, you're straight edge, but you look like a meth addict. CM Punk saying you're a less relevant version of The Miz. And it's just, oh, it's been so good. And then they have the chemistry together and it leads. And the great thing is it's a match that could lead to more matches. This doesn't feel like quite like the end of the road for these two yet, which is what I really, really like. What have you made on the whole of CM Punk's return to to wrestling rather than WWE?
I've really enjoyed it. You know, I know, I think here's the thing, doing this now after he's had, I think it was an 11 match winning streak. But the matches that he had were always competitive. They were always like, you know, good matches. And he's putting over young AEW talent. I think his presence on the roster has done wonders for certain people. And I love the fact that he's using his legacy to push more people forward. I think that can only be a net positive. And heck, the boy can still go. Like a 40-minute match, that's not easy to do.
And that is where, like, the fact that he's been away for so long, he's refreshed mentally, physically, emotionally, and you feel that when he's in there as well. And I think return to AEW was absolutely the right thing to do. I feel like it's a much better homestead for him. You can tell that, and this is where, like, I see so much of this with AEW guys. There's such a, for the most part, there is such a creative fulfillment that you see from them, which you don't see anywhere else.
I sense that. I mean, Chris Jericho talks about it quite often on his podcast about how sort of like, you know, the freedom to construct their own stories and like pitch and like, you know, it feels like so much more of a collaborative atmosphere than other promotions. And I think you can sense that because, you know, it allows them to go on these sorts of flights of fancy of like MJF Punk or like, you know, I think in the end we got like 90 minutes of Paige Danielson with those two matches combined. You know, would they have, and so close together as well. Like those sorts of flights of fancy are great. And like, I don't know. I love the company. I love their ethos and I love what they're doing. And, you know, again, I've noticed like, on my list, I haven't included any women's wrestling, which is, you know, that's a shame on my part, but I thought the recency bias thing was more funny. But like, you know, you can talk about, I mean, someone like Serena Deeb at the minute on sort of the beginnings of a monster heel run. Britt Baker, absolutely incredible talent, right at the top, one of the pillars of AEW for sure. Like this is such a good time to be a wrestling fan. Like so often we like wrestling fans, not that they're always angry and always want to complain, but like, I feel like we're probably in the best place we've been in quite a long time in terms of the breadth and scale of the wrestling that we're able to watch and the talent that's coming up. Like this is a good time to be a wrestling fan. It's what brought me back. It's why I'm here now.
I love that you said that. Cause I said almost exactly the same thing last week, last month. It's kind of a thing where I just say, like, when everyone complains about, like, oh, this isn't quite right now, this is the greatest time. There is so much choice. There is so many options. If you don't like one, you can like the other. But even if you don't like any of the modern stuff, you have access to every single wrestling match pretty much ever made on streaming platforms and the like. Like it's the best time to be a wrestling fan in 2022. It genuinely is. It's so good.
I mean, I don't have the WWE network at the minute because, as I say, I normally touch in for sort of like Royal Rumble and stuff like that. I watched, in preparation for this podcast, the 2018 Royal Rumble on YouTube for free.
That's very kind of them to do that, like, for you.
You know, they the biggest match at a Big Four pay-per-view, and it's for free on YouTube. You can just go and watch it. They've got loads of them up there as well.
They do chuck up the random little bit of gold. I think the other day they popped on Brock Lesnar versus Hulk Hogan from 2002. I was like, whoa,
oh,
forgot
my.
About this little bugger.
Oh, dear. Oh, Brock.
Great fun watching Brock just batter Hogan. What a dream. It was great fun. But so
it's weird looking back now, considering when Brock was a prospect as opposed to being the end level boss.
That's it. And how quick he went from prospect to end level boss. He was like, he was truly the highlight of 2002, 20 years ago this year, since the Brockiversary, the 20th Brockiversary.
The Brockiversary.
If they WWE use that now, they're in trouble. Because he went from, like, he debuted the night after WrestleMania 18, and he was in the main event with The Rock by SummerSlam, and it didn't feel out of place. It didn't feel rushed. It didn't feel forced. It didn't feel contrived. It didn't feel like a mismatch. It felt perfect. And it was. And now he is, as you say, the final boss of wrestling.
I mean, you could almost use it as a verb now, like, you know, to Lesnar someone to the championship. You know, just good booking on an absolute hulking monster. Yeah, we'll buy it. We'll buy it all day.
Ethan, it has been a pleasure to chat wrestling and life and the universe, according to Ethan Lawrence, with you. Where can people go to keep up with everything that you're up to next, sir?
First of all, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for having me. My socials are all unified. Ethan D. Lawrence. That's on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Bad Education Afterlife you can catch on Netflix. Horrible Histories you can catch on the iPlayer. It's all out there. You find it.
Can you give any little hints on what you're doing next?
You know, it's start of the year, so everything's sort of trickling in. I've got as many irons in the fire as I possibly can and just waiting for one to get hot.
On behalf of everybody listening today and watching today on the Cultaholic podcast feed, Ethan, don't forget it's bin day next week and take the other bin out. You've done the recycling. Take
absolutely.
The other bin
big
out.
Black bin for that one, yeah.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
For all the wrestling headlines in just 10 minutes, search Cultaholic Wrestling News on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.